Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. I'm so glad that you can join me today as we go back through the cardboard boxes and the folders and the plastic top loaders. Yes, your baseball card collection and mine. And we've got a good one this week. It's not one that'll make you a lot of money. It's just one of those bargain bin beauties. You buy it for a few bucks, you have some fun opening it up, and then you're wondering, what the hell am I going to do with all these cards? Yes, 89 tops. And you always remember your first. No, not that first. I'm not going to kiss and tell. I don't remember much of it anyways. We were both intoxicated, but she was a lovely young lady. Your first baseball card. We've discussed this before about that first time that you bought a pack of baseball cards, or maybe it's not a pack. Maybe it's the first time you just opened up a shoebox. You're at a friend's house and he's got a whole bunch of cards and you open them up and you look at them and you're like, oh, this is kind of neat. And that's how you get sucked into the industry. Well, it's an industry now. It used to be a hobby. That's how you got sucked into collecting baseball cards. And if you've listened to this podcast long enough, you know, for me, it was 89 tops. And the legendary story of 31 years ago, my mother taking me to a local grocery store, buying a few packs, and the rest, as they say, is history. And we'll talk a little bit about 89 tops. I know we were in 1989 just a few weeks ago talking about Upper Deck. But while Upper Deck was changing the game, Topps was keeping it the same. Like the Talking Heads, same as it ever was. There was no need for the Topps chewing gum people, in their minds at least at the time, to change anything. And from an aesthetic standpoint, I 100% agree. Even though I am not putting or paying down any debt in my life with my collection of 1989 Topps cards. In fact, if you buy too many of those boxes, you will put yourself into debt because of that. But because I am not going to be paying down a lot of debt with 89 Topps, it is just one of those fun things that you open up. And because it was my first card, my first pack, my first set really initiating me into the baseball card collecting hobby, which I went 150% into starting in the 1990 season, I always have great memories of the cards. And even as I was opening up these packs, and you can watch the pack break on our YouTube channel, it's Wax Ecstatic 1989 Topps Wax Break. Even though I got some, let's be honest, common cards, even though I got some star cards as well, even though I had plenty of cards with a nice thick gum stain on the back of them, it was still a blast just to open these. And I may have spent $5 or $6 on this box at a local card show, but it's still a lot of fun to not only just rip open the packs, not only try to find those last few cards that I need to complete a set, but also just to smell the gum while I'm cursing at it for staining some cards. Just have that intoxicating cardboard wax and gum smell that you don't get in baseball cards anymore. To have that, to have some childhood memories, some names that leapt off of the cardboard coming at me, and realizing too that I basically had a little bit of fun just for a couple dollars. You know, it's not that easy to get easily entertained for $5 or $6, but if you're a sports card collector and you don't mind opening up some vintage stuff and wondering what you're going to do with the 600 cards that aren't valuable that you don't need to fill the holes in a collated set, as long as you don't mind that, it's a fun little adventure there. So we'll dive a little deeper into the bargain bin beauty that is 89 Topps in just a little bit. And that also leads me to a question that I will pose to you, and we will put this on our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter timeline. And that is, what was your first pack of cards that you opened up? I know you still remember it. Many of you have been listening for a while. You may have taken a long hiatus from collecting cards. For me, it was a good, I'd say probably 12 years, 13 years for me. And then I got back into it. I know there are others that went 20 or 25 years between buying packs. Some of you have been collecting all your life. But no matter what your situation is, some of you may not even collect cards. You may have not have bought a pack in 30 years, but you still remember that first pack. Or again, maybe it wasn't a pack. It was that first exposure to baseball cards or any sport cards. You know, maybe it was football or hockey that got you into the hobby first. But go ahead and share those. Tag us at Wax and Gum Stains. We'll share some of the answers in our next podcast, which will be coming 2 weeks from today. That will be Friday, January the 31st. And we will share those comments as well as looping it into some great stories, because I know some of you have them. You remember buying that first pack or getting your hands on those first cards. And even though it may have happened 25, 30, 40 years ago, you still remember it like it was yesterday. I remember it like it was yesterday. And you still remember the sights, the sounds, the smells, the excitement of opening up those packs. So again, tag us at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Let us know what that first exposure to baseball cards was. Was it a pack? Was it a complete set? Maybe somebody bought it for you for Christmas. Or maybe it was, like I said, you went over to a friend's house, or maybe your older brother had a box of cards and you opened it up and you were just blown away at what was in there. Let me know, and I'll be happy to share those stories in our next podcast, which again will be coming 2 weeks from today, the 31st. Speaking of Wax Ecstatic, we do come your way every other Friday via our home base at Audio Boom and also on Apple Podcast, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Spotify, Google Play, and numerous other avenues. Just make sure that you latch onto that RSS feed and have Wax Ecstatic dropped into your podcast pocket every couple of weeks. Follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. And don't forget to rate the podcast as well, especially if you're on Apple Podcast. A lot of the platforms do offer some way of reviewing and or rating a podcast. Be honest, if you like what we do here, give us a good rating, give us a good review. What that does is, within the algorithm in that platform, the more positive reviews, the more 4 or 5 star reviews that you get, it bumps you up the list for recommended listening. So somebody may be listening to another sports card podcast or just another sports related podcast, and in that little suggested listening window that most of these platforms have, the more positive reviews we get, the more people get exposed to Wax and Gum Stains and Wax Ecstatic. So we want to make sure that we get the word out there. So I appreciate all of you who have done the rating and reviewing. And if you haven't yet, again, just take 2 minutes on your podcast platform to do that for us. Also, if you have the chance, you survive the holidays, the budget's been approved at work, maybe you got that hard-earned 2.6% raise, as the case often is. If you have a few extra shekels, feel free to send them our way. Make a donation to the Wax Ecstatic tip jar that is at paypal.me/Wax Ecstatic. And Wax Ecstatic is all one word there. paypal.me/Wax Ecstatic. The money that you donate goes to the program in one of two ways. One, it goes to the maintenance of the program. In order for us to have a show on Audio Boom, we've got to pay Audio Boom. So there is a fee to do that. And that also covers the cost of keeping the archived shows, our past 140 plus shows from the last few years, free to the public. We could slap a price tag on them, and if you wanted to listen to them or download them, you'd have to pay for it. But I'd rather not go that way. I like to keep it free, and the way that we keep it free is through generous donations. Also, your money goes into the purchase of products. I've got a card show right here in town in Tampa that I'm going to tomorrow. So I will try to restock not only on Bargain Bin Beauties, but a few suggested cards as well. Always scouring the eBay wires, if you will, trying to find some good bargains. Getting harder with some of these older cards, but always keeping my eye out for product that we can share on this show. And it may be an unopened box or an unopened pack of cards. It may be a lot of cards, or it may be some single cards. And that's certainly been part of the show over the last few months, whether it's the Renata Galasso series of cards that I was kind of reintroduced to while at a card show a few months ago, or if it's the Kellogg's cards and the postcards and the TCMA cards that a lot of our listeners have brought up in conversation. If you're talking about it, if I can find it and I've got the funds to purchase it, I will, and we'll talk about those particular cards on the program. And also give you credit, too, if you say, hey, I want to talk about this, and if I can track this down and have a nice little entertaining conversation about it, I will certainly give you a shout-out along the way. And speaking of shout-outs, I'd like to tell David Moody, thank you very much for your generous donation to paypal.me/waxecstatic. He included a message. Matt, keep up the good work. I would like, number one, more discussions of 1970s Tops, any of those years. Absolutely. I'm always looking for the 1970s. And in fact, he even made a notation here to contribute enough for a 1974 Tops baseball pack break. Looking for them, tricky to nail some of them down. I was in the hunt not only for 74 Tops, but I had some bids on 75 and 76 packs. I think the seller on eBay mysteriously ended the sale about 2 minutes before it was supposed to. So I don't know if someone came along and just said, hey, I'll pay you, you know, $300 for all three packs or whatever. Or maybe the bids were not getting goosed enough to where the seller just went, oops, I don't have this anymore, and just ended the auction. I hate that. But I am on the lookout for those particular packs, David. And also, as an idea that I had this past year, and it was a little past when I should have thought of it. I should have thought of it years ago. But when the Topps Heritage set comes out, and it is scheduled to be released on February 26th, we will do, much like we did last year, a deep dive into not only the 2020 Topps Heritage cards, but the set that they are modeled after, and that is the legendary 1971 set. And the 71 set is a blessing and a curse for collectors. A blessing because it is a very unique design. It is a classic design, a memorable design. So many features in the 71 set that were never done before on a Topps card. Some were not attempted again until 20 years later. And of course, it's a curse too because of the black borders. It is nearly impossible to find PSA 9 or 10, never mind 9 or 10, 7 or 8 condition cards for a lot of the 1971 set. So we will go deep into the weeds on the 71 Topps set probably in about 2 months. Like I said, February 26th is the scheduled release date for the Heritage set. Retail will be a few days after the hobby release. And once I get my hands on some of those cards, we'll take a look at the classic 71 cards as well, compare and contrast, and relive not only memories from 71 and that great series, but also looking ahead to the current set of 2020 Topps Heritage cards. So we will definitely take care of that. Also, David mentioned in his comments that he would like a podcast partially dedicated to the 1989 Topps auction. David, I know you suggested that several months ago in another donation. That is one of those things I do want to get on, and I actually want to try to work with somebody over at Topps, or at least somebody who's been a little more steeped in the history of card collecting who can provide some information on that. Maybe I can get a hold of Dave Jameson. Not really sure, you know, who to reach out to that, but I will work on that over the next couple of months because it is a fascinating topic. And it just, again, it happened when I just started collecting cards. So it really wasn't something that I even knew about until a few years ago, actually, when I read Jameson's book about the history of the baseball card industry. So we will work on that, I promise you. And also, a very interesting point here, a discussion about Topps stock when it was publicly traded. I do know, I don't know if I could turn a full podcast into it, but I do know that Topps was a publicly traded company multiple times. First of all, as the Topps Chewing Gum Company, and that goes back to the 1970s. And I have found online a couple of Topps certificates, Topps Chewing Gum / Bazooka Joe Chewing Gum certificates that, I'd love to buy them, except they're several hundred dollars. That's what they're going for. They're probably valued higher now than they ever were. But I found a couple from 1978. There was one that was 100 shares. I forget what the amount was for the other one. But again, they were ranging, you know, $300-$500 for this, you know, 40-year-old stock certificate. It wasn't really worth my time to go invest in it. I can quite frankly think of better ways to invest $400 if somebody gave it to me rather than get an old piece of stock. But I will share that picture of what I found on wax and gum stains over the next couple of days, so you can check that out. I do also know that the Topps baseball cards, so not the chewing gum, but the baseball cards, Topps was publicly traded, I want to say, from the mid-80s up until they went private in 2007. I haven't seen any proof of that. Of course, as things became more digitized in the 1980s, especially on Wall Street, you had less and less physical paper copies of stock that you purchased. It was all just numbers on a board and inside a computer. So I don't think that there's a whole lot of actual physical paper copies of stock from those latter years when Topps was a publicly traded company. Topps has been private, like I said, since 2007. I recall reading something about a year ago that the owners are looking to sell the baseball card side of Topps. And I don't know if anything has come of that. I don't know if the private equity group that owns Topps now would just look to sell it to another private equity group. I don't know if a company like Upper Deck, you know, they can exact their revenge on Topps by buying the Topps brand and doing what they may with that. I don't know. But from what I recall, nothing has really moved on that. And of course, the Topps company, because they are the exclusive maker of Major League Baseball cards, and there are also some Minor League Baseball cards. They have a soccer series, some wrestling cards as well, not to mention a lot of digital products as well as heritage products. You can make your own baseball card, not only using contemporary designs, but some selected designs from the past 65 years of Topps history. You can do all that, so there's a lot of things that the Topps company does these days. But it is a limited niche audience. You know, there's only so much more it can grow. There's only so much you can cut from the existing structure of it. It is a pretty lean organization from what I understand. So I don't know how appealing it is to anybody else. But it'll be interesting to see if Topps gets sold, if they're sold to another private investor or a private equity group, or if it goes public once again. You never know how those things turn out, though. As the history of baseball cards tells you, sometimes a sale to a bigger company, even with a company with deeper pockets, is not always the best thing, because you become asset number 30 of 300 when you're swallowed up by some of these big corporations, as opposed to being, you know, maybe one of the top 5 or 10 products in a much smaller operation. So again, David, thank you for the donation. Thank you for the show topic suggestions as well. Like I said, I've always got my eyes on 1970s material and looking to get a pack from 74 or 75 or 76. I do personally own a pack of each of those years, but that's just kind of stored away in my collection. Would like to find one for a good price that's out there somewhere. So again, with your donation, we can make that possible. And I'll keep an eye out at this upcoming show I'm at, too, to see if anybody has anything of the vintage kind in unopened wax for you. Also, just a heads up to the show, I have considered, I don't know if I'm going to do this, but as time has come along and as I've been exposed to some of the cards from the years that I didn't collect, namely from 1994 to up about 2003 or 2004, somewhere around there, I may actually purchase some packs from those years and open them and discuss them. And, you know, even though it's a pretty forgettable stretch of time in the baseball card hobby, I think it is worth revisiting those. And one of the interesting hooks to this particular podcast was I only wanted to talk about cards that were in my personal collection. So thankfully, I had collected a broad swath of cards when the podcast started. You know, I had cards going back to the mid-1950s up until 1993. And of course, over the years, I've been able to acquire more and more cards from the early 50s, the 1940s, and even the 1930s now. So as I collect some of those other cards, not only from the old days, I am looking into, hey, maybe I can purchase some packs from the mid to late 90s and talk about some of those cards, some of the challenges that the hobby was dealing with then, and also certainly some of the players, which I know a lot of you really enjoy. Also, I want to give a shout out to my friend Mike McLaughlin, Coach Mike, as he's known in these parts. He came up with a great idea that I will probably flesh out a little bit. In fact, this may be the next show. But talking about the rookie cards where you had shared rookie cards and the guys who, quote unquote, ruined a rookie card. And I think you know what I'm talking about. It was something that Topps did in the 1960s and 70s and also the early 80s. And they got away from it in 1983, and I think I understand why. Because the 82 Topps Cal Ripken Jr. rookie card is one of those three-player rookie cards, and you had Cal flanked by two other Baltimore Orioles that most of time has forgotten since 1982, and Topps had to release basically a solo rookie card for Cal Ripken in 1982 in the traded set. And I think ever since then, they shied away from the multiple player cards. That is until 1992. They kind of went back to that where you had four players featured on a card. So we had a fun little text conversation back and forth about, famous players, Hall of Fame players who share a rookie card with otherwise forgettable players. So I'll keep an eye out for that at that card show. I'll also scour my current collection. I don't have a Nolan Ryan, Jerry Kuzman, 68 Topps rookie card. That is one of the more famous examples, although Kuzman had a hell of a career, so that's not the best example. But I will go through my collection. I'll see what rookie cards I have from the 70s and 80s and early 90s that fit that description. And we can have a really fun show about the other guy, as it's referred to. You know, it's... You know, hey, look at this rookie card. It's Tom Seaver and that guy. It's Phil Niekro and that guy. It's Steve Carlton and that guy. Or Pete Rose and these guys. So we'll take a look at some famous other band members, if you will. In fact, there's a musical angle to this. I'm already thinking of it, but I'm not going to say it yet. But that may be the next show. It's a great idea. So, Coach Mike, thanks again for putting that bug in my ear. That is something that we will work on over the next few weeks here. Now, if you have any comments, questions, suggestions, what have you, again, you can reach me at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. And I do like to do informal polls there as well. In our last show with the leftover packs, and I'm still, you know, kind of like that leftover box of Chinese food that's been in the back of your fridge for a week. You're still kind of feeling it a couple days later. Well, here we are, you know, a couple weeks later, and I'm still kind of burned by some of those crappy packs that I got inside that package of cards. And I still haven't opened the 90 Donruss pack. I will hang that over your heads as a threat if you don't make that cash donation to the PayPal account. But I haven't opened the Rock Stars of 1991 pack yet. I still may do that just for the hell of it down the line. But in that pack of cards, as you know, I had a pack of, I think it was Series 3 Garbage Pail Kids from 1986. And even though this is a sports card show, a baseball card show in particular, I have threatened people to open up hockey packs, and they've threatened me with pitchforks and torches as well. Even though this is a baseball card show, I don't want to dive too deep into the non-sports, because that is a rabbit hole that just gets out of hand, not just vintage, but contemporary as well. But Garbage Pail Kids made a big impact on my generation. And I know, just looking at the statistics of the podcast, most of you are roughly my age. I'm 42. You're either a few years older or a few years younger than me. And you were probably in elementary school or maybe the early years of middle school when Garbage Pail Kids came out. And even though it's not sports, it may be worthwhile diving into because it made a huge cultural impact around 1986, 87, waned a little bit in the late 80s, but was such a cultural impact that Topps actually brought back the Garbage Pail Kids a few years ago. And I asked, should we do a podcast about the Garbage Pail Kids? Well, we had some suggestions. Brian Kilby said, funny enough, I'm actually sorting some Garbage Pail Kids as I sit here listening to this episode. If you decide to do that episode, I have some vintage unopened wax packs that I could donate to the cause. Well, Brian, yes, I don't want too many of those, maybe just a couple, but I certainly do appreciate the offer, and we will definitely take you up on that. Also, adding to the conversation about the Garbage Pail Kids / non-sports discussion, we have our good friend Tim Curry, greatest Twitter handle ever. No, not the actor. Well, I was prepared to say no, but then I opened the pick of Drillin' Dylan. That was one of the Garbage Pail Kids. And now I'm thinking it might be entertaining. All right, so we will take that into account. We can definitely do that. John Grochowski says, speaking as a librarian, you do wonderful research, so I'd be totally down for a podcast on this, even though Garbage Pails missed me by a year or so. But my younger brother was into them, so I have a small foundation of knowledge. And he continues, and by quote-unquote knowledge, I mean I looked at his packs, handed them back, and said, oh, that's nice. I was kind of the same, too, mostly because I didn't have a whole lot of money to go buy those anyways, and because they were so controversial, my parents really wouldn't let me go buy any in the store. I do remember getting some kind of as a gift, however, so we can share more on that. And a great suggestion from Mark Fricky, and I hope I'm saying that correctly there, Mark. I'd love one on wacky packages. Collected them then and still have them all. Mark, that's a great suggestion, and that is something that I will announce here. We will do a look back at Garbage Pail Kids, but also wacky packages. And wacky packages, very similar to Garbage Pail Kids, just a little sooner. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, Topps did these stickers that were basically mock products. It was, a play on words of brand names and, big trends that were going on at that time. And kind of think of it as a cross between Mad Magazine and Garbage Pail Kids. So just these irreverent stickers making fun of current products or people associated with current products in the late 70s. So I will dive into that. I'll keep an eye out for those at this upcoming show as well, because I do recall one dealer was selling some wacky packages the last time I was there. So we'll take a look at those, but we will do one combined podcast sometime within the next couple of months where we look at the Garbage Pail Kids and the wacky packages, two items that were very popular not only back in the day, but somewhat controversial and good enough to bring back, because Topps brought back wacky packages as well several years ago. And I don't know if they had a 2019 edition, but I do know they had wacky packages with current, mockumentary, if you will, looks at products and personalities over the past few years. So thank you everybody for your feedback on that. That is something that will be our one foray into non-sports that we will go into. And actually, the timing's pretty good in between the baseball season. You know, the new product doesn't roll out until late next month. So this may be a good time for us to go ahead and go into that. Had a couple of very nice comments here from listeners as well. Bart Hardman stating, absolutely love your podcast. And how do you know so much about all the players you talk about? It's awesome. I love it. Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Bart. I don't know everything. I know a lot to be dangerous. But I have, in my 25 years of broadcasting and radio and television, I have a very simple rule for talk show hosts. And that's essentially what podcasters are, your talk show hosts. And that is, know as much as you can know about what you're talking about. And what you don't know, know where you can find it fast. So that's been my golden rules of show prep, as we call it. Basically, not just turning on a microphone and talking, which way too many broadcasters do, but actually knowing what you're going to talk about. So for example, as I'm opening up these packs of 89 tops, I'm kind of keeping a little, you know, checklist in the back of my head going, okay, this player might be interesting. Oh, I remember this guy. Oh, this guy's got a good story to tell. And then it's just going back and doing a little research. And a lot of it, I've got to give a lot of credit to the Sabre people when they do write the articles, the biographies that are assigned to them. And that's the Society of American Baseball Research, of course, the people behind the Sabre metrics. They do a great job of doing the research and sourcing it, too. So whenever I can get information about a player through a Sabre feature, I will give them all the credit in the world because they really do some incredible deep dives. The High and Inside podcast says Wax and Gum Stains, that's us, is the best possible baseball card podcast out there. I highly recommend it. Well, so do I. Thank you very much. And lastly, speaking of bargain bin beauties and some junk wax, we've got it from Sam Olson and also the Two Strike Noise podcast. First, let's start off with Sam. He sent us a note several days ago. He says, I'm not a huge fan of 1991 Fleer, but there was some fun finds in this rack pack. And he sent us a picture of, you know, some notable players here, some Hall of Famers. You've got Dennis Eckersley. You've got Cal Ripken Jr. You've got Ken Griffey Jr. and Barry Bonds sharing a card. It's second-generation stars. You've also got Barry Larkin and Randy Johnson and Don Mattingly. You've got some prominent names from that day. Robin Ventura, Wally Joyner, Kirk Gibson, Jim Abbott, Travis Fryman. And you've also got a Bo Jackson art card, which is just a thing of beauty when you realize that boy, if we knew then what we know now, that would be the last of Bo Jackson in his prime that we would see after that hip injury that he suffered in a playoff game for the Oakland Raiders. He, you know, took a couple of years to rehab, played with the White Sox for a couple of years, and then that was it, really robbing Bo not only of a great two-sport career, but robbing us as fans as watching that. It's just amazing what could have been with Bo Jackson. And I think the same thing too, Sam, is speakable of 91 Fleer. You know, what could have been had Fleer, and if you look at the picture, there's some great action shots on here, but had Fleer just found a better way to frame these pictures, to design that card, why? And I recall in the early 90s, you know, bright, wild colors were the thing. You know, think back to the music and the culture, and you know, it was bright, vivid. There was a lot of color in the early 90s, not all that different from, you know, the mid to late 70s, or well, early 70s for that matter. But I distinctly remember, you know, light tones like teal and purple and, you know, light oranges. You know, those were kind of the in looks at the time. And why somebody just said, all right, let's grab mustard yellow, make it look boxy, and make it look like a typewriter wrote out the names of these players on wide-ruled paper. I just don't know what the thought process was in the design of the 91 Fleer set, especially when you look at what Fleer had done the previous, what, 7 or 8 years. I was a big fan of Fleer in the mid to late 80s, and even some of their cards, like 88 and 89, I wasn't thrilled about, but they were pretty decent. Big fan of 1990, even though it's kind of conservative. It still had a little bit of a flair to it, a little Office Space reference there. But I just don't know what went into the design process. And of course, the 91 Fleer set just sunk to the bottom of the ocean. And that dragged down the Fleer Ultra set as well, as we've discussed numerous times on this program. And it really set the stage and set the bar really high for Fleer in 1992. And I think for the most part, they reached it. We've talked about the Fleer base set, Fleer Ultra in 1992 as well. I thought they recovered extremely well. But all these years later, you know, it's 29 years now, 91 Fleer is mocked, and there's plenty of it out there. So it's kind of a sad thing when you look at some of these cards and go, wow, look at some of the photography. Look at some of the things that they were doing, like a full-color headshot on the back. Granted, Score and Upper Deck had beaten them to the punch several years before. But, you know, Fleer was trying to shake it up a bit. But why they came up with that particular design, I don't know. Two Strike Noise also responding. I happened to open two packs of 91 Fleer today for our podcast. There is something familiar about them. Can't quite put my finger on it, though. Glad you had better luck. And they sent us a picture of these two wax packs where the sequencing was the exact same. They got pretty much card for card, with the exception of maybe two, three cards in here, exactly the same cards. Now, if the cards they got were Frank Thomas and, you know, a Louis Gonzalez rookie and Tino Martinez rookie and Barry Bonds or Cal Ripken, you know, you'd go, oh, this is a good one. No, it's Derek Lilliquist and Tom Gordon and Sean Donston and John Russell and my favorite, Tom Pagnozzi. You know, you can never have enough 91 Fleer Tom Pagnozzi cards in your collection. So thanks to everybody who not only commented on our question about the non-sports stuff. So we will do a combined podcast featuring Garbage Pail Kids and also Wacky Packages. I'll, like I said, try to accumulate some of those over the next few weeks. But for sharing your card finds as well, I know a lot of our listeners are starting to rediscover some of those junk wax sets that you kind of pushed off 20 or so years ago. They are fun and cheap finds and you know, a cheap way to entertain yourself. And, you know, really appreciate everybody who's sharing those stories, sharing those pictures. And also, if you're sharing those cards, a shout out to a longtime listener and contributor, not only with commentary and show ideas, but Nathan McNeely sending me a few, almost a couple hundred cards here to help not complete, but get closer to completing the 87, 88, and 89 top sets that I'm hand collating. And maybe you're wondering, well, what are you doing with those? I'm just going to keep them. You know, I got rid of so many of those cards years ago. I'm just going to keep these complete hand collated sets. If I have enough for two, maybe I'll pass them along to my son. I don't know if it's a good gift now. You know, he just turned 10. My God, he's 10. Or, you know, do I wait for high school? I don't know. But anyways, you know, they're just fun little things to keep, and hand collating those sets. It's a nice way of collecting those junk wax cards without having 4,000 of these cards around. So Nathan, thanks again for the dupes. I really appreciate it. And we'll certainly keep in touch if I build out some other sets and I'm looking for some extras. Oh, one last thing before we talk about 89 Tops. Speaking of dupes, if you've got thousands of cards laying around you don't know what to do with, make sure you donate them to Commons for Kids. They are a benefactor of the extra cards that we have. So that money that you donate through paypal.me/waxecstatic, when we buy a box of cards or we buy several packs of cards to open up and share and discuss on the program, any excess cards that we have, we put them all in a box, and over a few months, we collect these boxes and we send anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 of these cards to Commons for Kids. Great organization. They take your comments, not just baseball, not just past. Send some current stuff too, please. And they take all these cards and they donate them to kids who either can't afford to have baseball cards, so it's a nice little free gift to them, but also for kids who are just dealing with some kind of adversity right now. Maybe they're in the hospital. Maybe they're dealing with a life-threatening or, God forbid, a terminal illness that they're fighting right now. Or maybe they're just down on their luck. They're in some kind of a program that requires them to stay after school somewhere away from family, or requires them to stay with a step family, stuff like that. This is where Commons for Kids helps out. They put the cards in the kids' hands. So whether it's kids just not being able to afford cards, or it's kids who just need something positive to deal with in a very negative space in their life, that's where Commons for Kids comes in. And we are very happy to not only send cards their way, but also to promote their cause. So you can follow them on Twitter at Commons4Kids. That's the number 4, Commons4Kids, to find out more information on what they're looking for and how you can send your excess cards as well. Now, when we're talking excess cards, boy, 1989 Tops seems to come up to the top of the list, doesn't it? Well, to be honest with you, like I said, 89 Tops, because it was my first set of cards, is always memorable to me. And I know some collectors probably could care less. I remember, in fact, when I bought that box of cards from the local card show a few months back, my friend Coach Mike says, you know, you probably paid more for it than what's in there. And you know what? You're right. There's no cards, to my knowledge, that are worth a dollar or more. I think there may be like an uncorrected error card somewhere that's worth a few bucks. But, you know, there's nothing about 89 Tops where you get really excited like 89 Upper Deck and you go, well, maybe I'll get a Griffey. You can't even get a Griffey in the 89 Tops base set. For some strange reason, they decided to hold that over until the Tops traded set. So while that certainly created some urgency for the traded set, it leaves the base set high and dry. Now, the good news, if you're a rookie card hunter or a young star hunter, you can find some really good Hall of Fame players, or even if they're not Hall of Fame, notable players who had those early career cards in the 89 set. Best example, in fact, I saw some of them while I was opening up the packs, Roberto Alomar, you get a rookie card there, Brady Anderson as well. You know, he's not a Hall of Famer, but he had a pretty decent career, if you recall. Tom Glavine, second Topps card, is in there as well. I even pulled from one of the packs an Andy Bennis first-round draft pick card. Now, nobody's preparing a plaque for Andy Bennis in Cooperstown, but again, this was one of those few times that Topps was able to take one of those first-round draft picks and guess correctly that that player would have a decent career in the major leagues. And then, of course, all the stars from the mid to late 80s, including your Barry Bonds, including your Daryl Strawberries and your Roger Clemens and your Ryan Sandbergs and all the other players, they're featured in there as well. So if you're somebody, and I know a lot of people who do this, especially with junk wax era cards, if you're somebody who will actually go through a box of cards and just dig out the Hall of Famers or the notable rookie cards, because they are junk wax, you can buy them for 10 or 15 cents a pop, then 89 Tops is a great set to do this. And it's not only good for some notable rookies from the late 1980s and some Hall of Fame players from the 70s and 80s who were still playing at that time, but 89 Tops has a memorable design, not gaudy, not revolutionary by any stretch of the imagination, but I like to refer to it as an all-American design. It is just simple. It just has this almost like a Dodgers script. Think of the Dodgers word mark on the front of the uniform, something that they've had since 1938 in that style with very few adjustments. But what is so memorable about that design of the Dodgers script on the front of their uniforms is basically what you see on the front of 89 Tops. Minimal borders, nice clean white border, but it's not too big. It's not boxing out everything else on the card. The Dodger script, if you will, that featured the team name in some kind of appropriate team colors. And in the tail of that script from the team name, you had the player name. And you didn't have a lot of great action photos. You didn't have a lot of lighthearted, silly photos. A lot of the pictures in 89 Tops are posed pictures. They're headshots in many cases. So you don't have a whole lot of creativity there. But you have a very basic, I don't want to call it conservative, but just kind of a clean look. And that was something that Topps was going for in the late 80s, which is really saying something considering you look back at what I like to call the Cyndi Lauper design of 1985, the very MTV look of 85 Topps. Then you have the boxy but popular 86 Topps. You had the infamous wood grained look in 87. Scaling it back, simplifying it in 88, keeping that simplification in 1989. Then they just went the opposite direction in 1990, although I wasn't against it. It was very contemporary in 1990. But in 1989, it was a very clean, simple look on the front. You flip the card over, and the backs of 89 Tops are also memorable because it featured an ink color combination that wasn't all that common back then. They used black along with kind of a dark pinkish red color, most reminiscent to the 69 Topps cards, although in 69 the pink was more prominent with the black text. And also somewhat like 86 Topps. 86 was very unique with the red backs and the black text. This was kind of a reddish, pinkish color along with the black text. But even though it was a very unusual color combination, it worked out. And it is memorable because, again, a lot of people my age were kids when they collected it. That was often the first set that you collected, or maybe one of the first sets that you collected. It was also the most easy to find. You know, Topps baseball cards were everywhere back in the day. And of course, as the hobby was exploding in the late 80s and early 90s, you could buy baseball cards anywhere. But Topps had the advantage at that point in time of being in the business for almost 40 years. They knew how to work the wholesale market. They knew how to work the retail market. They knew how to work the hobby market. They knew how to get that product in front of everybody. So you can pick it up at a baseball card shop, you could pick it up at a drugstore, you could pick it up at a local grocery store, such as the cases I did. They just got that product out there. So chances are one of those late 80s or early 90s Topps sets was the first that you saw. So even though it was a bizarre color combination, and it's something that to my knowledge they didn't use again, certainly a pink and black look. And of course, Topps got a lot more fancier with the designs and the color combinations as they switched to the white cardstock in 1992. And of course, the demands of base sets, the quality of them increased over the years. They kind of shied away from just putting together wacky color combinations on the back of cards. So I think that's another reason why it's so memorable. This was one of those last sets before base sets became premium looking, and premium looking sets, or premium sets, I should say, became kind of the base. You know, more people were buying the premium sets, more people were investing in them, more people saw the money in them, and the base sets kind of went by the wayside throughout the 1990s. So it's one of the last simple Topps sets, one of the quote-unquote innocent sets, I guess you could say. But again, recalling back to what we were discussing about with the 89 Upper Deck set a couple of weeks ago, it had to change eventually because Upper Deck in 1989 and 90 and 91 was eating everybody else's lunch. Topps was able to respond with that great Stadium Club set in 1991 that really challenged Upper Deck. But by then, the base set, you couldn't have simple, you couldn't have conservative, you couldn't have something that harkened back to a design from the 1960s or 1970s. It was all modern. It was all corporate. It was kind of cold looking in the 1990s. So I think that's another reason why people gravitate towards not just 89 Topps, but a lot of these junk wax sets from the 1980s. Because if you lived through that time period, if you collected through that time period, you recall that those were the last days where you could buy a pack of baseball cards for 45 cents. That's right. For 45 cents, you got 15 cards. You also got a piece of gum, and you got those goofy Topps Company store cards that were in there as well. Something about those, and I had actually blogged about these not too long ago. It was actually an ingenious move by the Topps Company. You know, for years they were running the spring training sweepstakes contest. And if you bought a pack of cards in, say, 85, 86, 87, you got that insert card that was basically the entry form for that contest. Now, this is before the internet, so you actually had to write down your name and address and stick it in an envelope and put a stamp on it and send it out. So, you know, these things, much like the subscription leaflets that are in magazines, just kind of fall out everywhere. That's the downside if you're going to open up a box of cards from 87 or 88, 89. You just have all these cardboard pieces falling out. So that's one of the hazards. But Topps, realizing that most collectors didn't want just this little entry form falling out of their packs, decided to repurpose it in 89 and 88, actually, where on the back of the card, you had the entry form for the spring training sweepstakes, but on the front of the card, you had these items for the Topps Company Store. And I always thought it was odd to name it the Company Store because the term Company Store has a very negative connotation in American labor history. The Company Store, if you don't know, was the store that sold, you know, food and material to miners, in most cases in Appalachia. So if you worked for the coal company and you're living up in the hills of West Virginia or Western Pennsylvania or whatever, you're not being paid a very good wage. You're in bad health because you're in a coal mine all day. You didn't have the luxury of a Walmart or a Wegmans or whatever around. You had to buy your stuff from the company store. And the company that owned the coal mine owned the store and would mark up all of these items and put a lot of their workers in debt. So the rather famous song, 16 Tons, you load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older, a deeper and deeper in debt. I owe my soul to the company store. That's the whole thing there, company store. You load 16 tons of ore or coal or whatever, and you just keep buying all this stuff from the company store and you're in debt. Well, if you look at some of the products from the company store cards, you can understand how you could lose a lot of money and probably a lot of your friends too, because these were just some incredibly geeky items, you know, puffy lettering t-shirts and sweatshirts. My favorite, the cap called the Furball, which was basically this 1980s puffy trucker hat with a Topps logo, but it also had a Velcro baseball that attached to the top of the bill, and you could move it, you could throw it around. These were the ultimate fanny pack items for baseball card collectors. If you had one of these and a fanny pack, you also had an atomic wedgie because nobody liked you, I'm pretty certain. Now, what's interesting, I actually, not too long ago, went searching. I'm like, did anybody actually buy any of these things or any of these up for sale somewhere? And I saw there's a company that claims to sell these sweatshirts that you saw in the company store cards. But judging by a lot of the Twitter bot responses to, you know, the item postings, it sounds like it's just some knockoff in the Czech Republic or Ukraine or whatever making these things. So I would not give them my credit card. But if you're just itching to buy one of these old Topps Company store t-shirts, perhaps you passed up on the opportunity or you grew out of your shirt 30 years ago, you could find a reasonable facsimile of them online, but I would pay cash and definitely not give up a credit card number there. So 89 Topps, if you don't mind the company store cards, if you don't mind the gum marring the cards, and I will post a picture. As I opened up the whole box, I determined that yes, indeed, I could assemble an all-star team of gum-stained players in this pack or in this box of cards. So we'll share that with you. So if you don't mind losing 36 cards to gum stains, it is still a fun buy, and especially if you can get them for just a few dollars. Now, as for some of those cards, I selected ones that weren't stained by gum or by wax, found some memorable names from the late 1980s here, including the Big O. No, not Orlando Cepeda, the other Big O, Orestes Destrada. And he may be better remembered for all the time that he played in Japan or for his current broadcasting career than anything he did on the field in America. But as for the Big O, he was born in Cuba and his family emigrated to Miami in the late 1960s. He was 6 years old and he would play in Tamiami Park and eventually graduated from Coral Park High School, later attended Florida College, which is not that far from me, a little town called Temple Terrace, just east of Tampa. Now, after college, he was drafted by the California Angels in the 23rd round of the 1980 amateur draft, did not sign, eventually was signed as an amateur free agent of the Yankees in 1981, very slowly worked his way up through the Yankees farm system, finally made his big league debut in September of 1987, but a very brief debut. He appeared in just 9 games, had 24 plate appearances, and eventually would get traded to the Pirates for another great 1980s baseball player named Hippolyto Peña. Now, that happened in spring training of 1988. So in this Topps card, he is featured, Orestes is, in a Pirates uniform. However, in 1989, he was not playing for the Pittsburgh Pirates. At this point in time, because he couldn't get past some of the other guys who were playing first base in particular, and in fact, he couldn't get a regular position or a regular role at the major league level, tired of playing in the minor leagues, he was able to jump over to Japan. He played four seasons with the Cebu Lions, and then when expansion came around in 1993, he jumped at that opportunity and was indeed a member of the inaugural Florida Marlins. How appropriate for him, as he was able to star for his hometown team. He was a free agent signee back in December of 1992, played 153 games for the Fighting Fish, if you will, had his most memorable year at the plate, hitting .255 and striking out 130 times. No, the more memorable part is he also hit 20 home runs and knocked in 87 runs as well. Now, at this time, of course, he's 31 years old, and the Marlins would eventually try to move up some of their younger players. So he didn't last very long in 1994, appeared in just 39 games in that strike-shortened season, hitting .208 with five home runs, and again would go to Japan to play for the Cebu Lions, and then his professional career would end after the 1995 season. Now, even though he didn't have an outstanding major league career, he was a star, as I said, in Japan. In fact, he was the MVP of the 1990 Japan series. So it's funny how you just have some players that just perform extremely well overseas and they struggle to find a consistent spot. And sometimes it's just the team you're on. Like I said, though, even though he was a star in Japan, he was able to be a star and a hometown hero for the Marlins in their first year. And afterwards, he became a broadcaster. In fact, I remember the radio station I was working for back in around 2004, 2005. He was visiting and he was starting to just make appearances on radio programs, and he would pop up on television programs as well, including Baseball Tonight on ESPN. He was a commentator for the inaugural World Baseball Classic in 2006, did a lot of broadcasts for the Little League World Series, did some shows on SiriusXM as well. And he has been a studio analyst and sometimes a color commentator for the Tampa Bay Rays on Fox Sports Sun ever since 2011. Now, he has this very interesting quirk, and I don't know if this is just like a nervous tic or something, but he almost always, I'd say 90% of the time, has to hold on to a baseball in his hand when he's on the air. I've seen Orestes before. I've flown on airplanes with him, to Fort Lauderdale from Tampa before. He doesn't always carry this ball around. It's not actually surgically attached to his hand. But it's a unique quirk. I don't know if it's just one of those comfort things when he's on air. He's nervous, so he just holds on to this baseball. It's kind of like a security blanket, but that's just one of his things. And he actually does this in radio broadcast as well, which is unusual, but hey, whatever gets you by, right? There is an interesting footnote to Orestes de Strada's career as well. He is officially the first major league strikeout in Randy Johnson's career. That's right. Randy Johnson, 4,875 strikeouts in the big league. Orestes de Strada, number one, baby, back in 1988 when the big unit was pitching for the Montreal Expos. Now, going from Montreal to Toronto, this was a name that I recalled and recall it well, because this was one of the most underrated relief pitchers in his time. Of course, I say that about a lot of Toronto Blue Jays players, but no, that was seriously the case when it came to Dwayne Ward, or as his birth certificate reads, Roy Dwayne Ward. Spent most of his career with the Blue Jays, two-time World Series champion with them, but was originally a member of the Atlanta Braves, which is rather ironic, don't you think, since Ward was able to get the first of those two World Series with the Blue Jays against his former team. As I mentioned, he was with the Braves, in fact, a first-round pick, ninth overall in the 1982 amateur draft. He was part of one of the many infamous Doyle Alexander trades that has happened in Braves history. Doyle Alexander traded from Toronto to Atlanta July 6th, 1986, for Dwayne Ward. And then, of course, Alexander later traded to Detroit for the Tigers' pennant run in 1987 for some guy named John Smoltz, who I think turned out to be a decent ball player. Despite that, Dwayne Ward would work his way up through the Toronto Blue Jays farm system, did have a brief cup of coffee with the Braves in 1986. It was nothing impressive, and the same could be said, too, for his time in Toronto that season. He eventually went back to Syracuse, their AAA club, worked out a few things, didn't have a spectacular 1987 season, but was able to figure things out in 1988. He became one of the best middle relievers and eventually would become the closer for the Blue Jays in 1993. That's right. People forget that Tom Henke left the Blue Jays after 1992. So some of the closer options were Dwayne Ward or Mike Timlin. And Ward actually led the American League in saves in 1993 with 45. So here's a guy who was basically just a throwaway player that a Blue Jays team that was good but not great in 1986 acquired to move the veteran Doyle Alexander to Atlanta, and they were able to mold him into a very respectable ball player. He had a great hard slider. You think about that Blue Jays team having, you know, guys that could, you know, pitch the pelota, you know, a fast hard ball, but then you had guys who were very crafty, like Ward, like Dave Steep with those hard sliders. They would twist these guys inside and out. Now, unfortunately, Ward would not have much of a career after the 1993 World Series, and that's because he had a whole bunch of injuries. In fact, he missed the entire 1994 season because of biceps tendonitis, and then after appearing in just five games for the Blue Jays in 1995, he decided to hang it up, and why not? His stats line from 1995 is pretty terrible. 2 2/3 innings, 11 hits, 10 runs, 8 earned, 5 walks to 3 strikeouts over 4 games. It was not a very pretty ending for an otherwise respectful, remarkable short career. However, so he finished with 121 career saves, and since 2014, Dwayne Ward has been part of the Blue Jays radio broadcast and occasionally fills in as a color commentator. Now, another pitcher who had a short but brief career and is definitely a product of Fernando mania would be Teddy Higuera. And I mentioned this during the pack break. You know, this was a guy who had a tremendous start to his career with the Milwaukee Brewers in the mid-1980s, but dealing with injuries later on in his career, it ended way too soon for the crafty left-hander. Now, as I mentioned, he was a product of Fernando mania. So think about the Dodgers scouting Fernando Valenzuela, and Fernando comes in the middle of that magical, controversial, strike-shortened 1981 season. He's a big key not only to the Dodgers winning the World Series that year, but also really bringing in a whole new wave, a whole new generation of Central American fans and Mexican fans. So with the success of Fernando, all of a sudden, Mexico, which used to be seen just kind of as a wasteland for, you know, former major league players, for borderline major league players, you know, guys that could just kind of plug in to positions here and there. Well, now Mexico was hot property. And in 1983, the Brewers would purchase his contract from the team he was playing for in the Mexican League. And he would spend just 1 year in the minor leagues and would appear in the Brewers' starting rotation in 1985. So just like that, Here's Teddy Higuera, again, you know, a talented guy, but pretty much a product of the Fernando mania, at the age of 27, making his debut and having a stellar rookie season. In fact, he was the runner-up to the Rookie of the Year Award in 1985. Anybody want to guess who the winner of the American League Rookie of the Year was? Ozzie Guillen. Yeah, you may have been thinking of some other players, but no, it was Ozzie Guillen. He won the Rookie of the Year, but it was Teddy Higuera who was the runner-up. And he followed that up with a spectacular All-Star 1986 season where he went 20-11. Never mind Rookie of the Year, this guy was the runner-up for the American League Cy Young Award. Now, he was going up against a buzzsaw in Roger Clemens in 1986. But what's interesting is, you know, I don't want to say that Teddy Higuera was just a product of Fernando mania. He and Fernando were kind of going hand in hand here for a couple of years, as Fernando was the runner-up in the National League voting, finishing behind Mike Scott of the Houston Astros. So he had this great 20-11 season in 1986, had some pretty respectable 1987 and 88 seasons. In fact, he was a candidate for the Cy Young Award, finished sixth in voting in 1987. But then the bottom starts dropping out because of injuries in the late 1980s. So when you see Teddy Higuera in this 1989 Topps card, this was kind of, unfortunately, the beginning and the end. He had back injuries, which also led to sprained ankles and vice versa. If you ever had a back issue, it leads to a lot of problems with your feet. And like I said, if you have feet issues, it can lead to a lot of problems with your back and neck. So he had back surgery, also several sprained ankle issues. And he had only 22 starts in 1989, actually had a pretty decent record despite all the injuries, was healthy in 1990, but did not have a very good season. In fact, had an 11-10 record. Then again, the Brewers were kind of in 1990 as well. Now, even though he was dealing with injuries, for some strange reason, the Brewers handed then 32-year-old Teddy Higuera a four-year, $13.1 million contract. That didn't age real well. In fact, Teddy Higuera did not age real well. He tore his rotator cuff in 1991, went through several surgeries, missed the entire 1992 season, and the last two seasons of that four-year contract, he appeared in a grand total of 25 games, 20 as a starter, never had an earned run average under seven. The Brewers basically let him be a free agent following that 1994 season. He tried to come back in San Diego in 1995, but did not make the opening day roster and retired. Now, he is a pitching coach. In fact, he represented Mexico in the World Baseball Classic in 2006, 2009, and 2013. And despite a brief major league career, put up some impressive numbers in his very short time, a 94-64 record, 3.61 earned run average, and 1,081 strikeouts. Like I said, not only an all-star, a runner-up for the Rookie of the Year in 85 and Cy Young Award in 86, part of the Miller Park Walk of Fame, and was inducted into the Mexican Professional Baseball Hall of Fame back in 2011. Last but certainly not least, we've got to talk about Greeny. Mike Greenwell, a better nicknamed as the Gator. And Mike Greenwell was one of those often forgotten, or I should say overlooked, players. And I think of left fielders in Boston Red Sox history. And this blew my mind 30 years ago when somebody told me, and it still blows my mind now. When you think of left fielders, you had Ted Williams, you had Carl Yastrzemski, you had Jim Rice, and you had Mike Greenwell. So for when did Williams come in? 39. So for almost a 50-year stretch, and that's not including, you know, injuries, or especially Ted Williams when he was away at World War II and the Korean War, you had four left fielders who basically fully occupied left field at Fenway Park for the Boston Red Sox over a 50-year stretch. That to me is just amazing. That is almost like the Pittsburgh Steelers head coaching position. And by the way, congratulations, Bill Cowher, on your induction to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. But, you know, the Pittsburgh Steelers over the previous, 50 years have had Chuck Knoll, Bill Cowher, and Mike Tomlin. And people will appreciate Mike Tomlin for his work later. But it's very similar to that, where you can count on one hand the number of starting left fielders for the Boston Red Sox for a 50-year time period. That is just amazing. So Mike Greenwell, born in Louisville, Kentucky, or as they say there, Louisville, fourth in Rookie of the Year voting in 1987, and he was a contender for the American League MVP award in 1988. However, missed out to Jose Canseco, of course. Canseco, with that 40-40 season in 1988, that put him over the top. And of course, it helps that the Oakland A's were consistently going to the World Series at that point in time. Boston was a contender. In fact, the A's beat the Red Sox in the 1988 playoffs. But that kind of edged out Greenwell in a lot of situations there. Greenwell did, however, in 1988, hit .325, 22 home runs, 119 RBI, which is pretty impressive. Now, as I mentioned, he was born in Louisville, Kentucky. However, grew up in the Fort Myers, Florida area, was a baseball and football star. However, was shifting towards baseball as his career went on. Drafted in the third round of the 82 Major League Baseball draft by the Red Sox, and he did sign with the team there. Greenwell hit for the cycle on September 14th, 1988, just the 17th player to do so in franchise history at that point in time. And also, Greenwell in 1996, in a game against the Seattle Mariners at the Old Kingdome, it was a 9-8 Red Sox win in 10 innings, and Greenwell drove in all nine of the runs for the Red Sox. That was a record for most runs driven in by one player, accounting for all of that team's runs in a single game. He also holds the American League record for most game-winning RBI in a single season. He had 23 of those in 1988, although that's not an official stat anymore. And for obvious reasons, he was inducted into the Boston Red Sox Hall of Fame in 2008. In fact, his entire Major League career was played with the Boston Red Sox from 1985 to 1996. Career 1,400 hits. I know he dealt with a lot of injuries later on in his career. Only played part of the 92 season, likewise 93, and 1996, as he was getting into his mid-30s, he was winding down as well, but still had a career batting average of .303 with 130 home run and 726 RBI in his career. Now, after his playing career in the major leagues, he would sign with the Hanshin Tigers of the Nippon Professional Baseball League in 1997. He was going to be a big star in Japan. However, he suffered a herniated disc while diving for a ball, would not play until midway through the 1997 season, and had to call his retirement much earlier than he thought. Now, after that, he moved on to become a coach. In fact, he was a player coach for the Chattanooga Lookouts in 2001, and eventually was the interim hitting coach for the Cincinnati Reds in 2001, filling in for Ken Griffey Sr., who was dealing with some medical issues at that time. Now, Mike Greenwell living up to the nickname of Gator. By the way, he got that nickname after capturing an alligator and taping its mouth shut and sticking it in teammate Ellis Burke's locker. This was when the Red Sox were spring training in Winter Haven, and the old Chain of Lakes Park in Winter Haven is, as the name implies, surrounded by lakes. And being a resident of Florida for most of my life, I know that if there is a puddle of water that is more than 2 feet wide and 2 inches deep, there is either an alligator or a snake in it. And there have been many stories of snakes and or alligators finding their way onto the property and the press box. You know, it was an open air stadium in Winter Haven over the years. Not just the Red Sox, but the Indians would train there for a while. So doesn't surprise me one bit that Greenwell found a gator in the area, caught it, taped its mouth shut and stuffed it in a locker. As I was saying, he is also living up to the nickname of Gator. After his baseball career, he began driving late model stock cars. He won the 2000 Speed Weeks Track Championship. And in May of 2006, he made his debut in the Craftsman Truck Series and raced there for several years, finally giving up the sport in 2010. He is still living in Florida, by the way, in South Florida, where he grew up in the area. And also, he has a couple of sons who he not only coached in Little League Baseball, but also who have made professional careers. Bo Greenwell was an outfielder drafted in the sixth round of the 2007 draft. Spent most of his career in the minor leagues. In fact, I believe all of his career in the minor leagues in the Indians and later Red Sox farm systems. And then Garrett, who was a first baseman, actually didn't have a professional career from what I can see. However, he was a starting member of the Santa Fe Community College before transferring to Oral Roberts University in 2013. So there is the underappreciated Mike Greenwell, somebody who is, you know, certainly not of Hall of Fame worthy status, but I always thought was a very unique tidbit in not just Red Sox history, but baseball history, as one of those four left fielders from basically officially 1940 to 1996. So for 56 years, he was a guy that you could count on when he wasn't injured to be in left field. Or for 56 years, I should say, there were four outfielders. He was the fourth before you started having more turnover for the Boston Red Sox. Now, he would also DH a lot and had to deal with that with his injuries later on in his life. But again, just a spectacular stretch of players in Red Sox history. Williams, Yastrzemski, Rice, and Greenwell. And I always like to acknowledge Mike Greenwell's part in that equation. He is often the one of the four that people overlook. And of course, understandably why, considering the careers of the other three. But Greenwell kept that chain going for several years after Jimmy Rice's departure and Greenwell's arrival in Boston. Well, that'll do it for our look back at the players from those 89 Topps packs, the ones that didn't have too many wax or gum stains on them. And again, an 89 Topps purchase, you're not going to get rich off of it. Don't spend more than just a few dollars for it. The only time you should put down $20 for a box of 89 Topps is if you're getting it on eBay and the shipping is $14. It's the only reason why you should spend double digits on a box of 89 Topps. And in fact, if you find somebody who's selling 89 Topps online and they are charging you shipping, you know, it's $14 for priority mail shipping, see if you can bargain a second box getting thrown in there. Because if you can't fit it into the medium-sized box, the large box, I believe it's $19.95 to ship. And if you're finding a dealer that just wants to get rid of this stuff, just go, hey, for $5 or $6 more, throw in a second box, increase the postage if need be, and just help me out here. So if you're just somebody that just likes ripping open packs, or like me, you're trying to hand collate a set, this is a great way to do it. Try to get some bargains while you can by buying some multiple boxes out there. Or go to your local card store, go to the nearest card show, because chances are there's somebody who's got a stack of 89 Topps boxes as well as other junk who will gladly just sell them two for $9 or something like that. And you've got yourself some entertainment for an hour or two on some rainy day. Well, hopefully this entertained you, not quite for an hour or two, somewhere in between. Where are we? About an hour and 20 now? Yeah, that's enough of me. Remember, you can send us your cash donations at paypal.me/waxecstatic. And we do appreciate all those people who have made donations before. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And if you haven't been able to yet, please consider doing so, as it does help us keep this program going, helps us keep purchasing those cards that we can discuss on the program. And again, a lot of these cards will end up in the hands of kids with Commons for Kids, who we donate all the excess cards to. And you can follow us at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Share that handle with a friend. Share the podcast as well. And don't forget to rate and review the podcast. We appreciate all commentary that comes in through the rate and review method or through the PayPal donations or through the tweets. We certainly appreciate your time investing in the program, literally and figuratively, and aurally as well. That's aurally, A-U-R-A-L-Y. Yeah, that reminds me of my first... never mind. We'll save that for some other show. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. You've been listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you 2 weeks from today with our next program.